Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to the show.
No football club is ever successful without handball.
Klubben. Hjertelig velkommen til fotballklubben episode
nummer 81.
Der kom kremtinga mi ganske
Kjempebra.
Hardt i gang.
For å starte sendinga.
Da våkner folk.
Ja, 81, ja. Fordi forrige uke var det 80B.
80B, stemmer det. 81A denne gangen.
Mm-hmm. I tilfelle noe går gærent.
Ja, vi har alltid åpningen. Vi legger inn en liten mulighet for det, og vi vet at ting går ikke alltid som det skal.
Ja, forrige uke så fikk vi en melding fra fyr som var skikkelig sur på Twitter. Hvorfor har dere sluttet med gjester? Og så prøvde vi å forklare at det har vært sommerferie, og alt imellom her har vært sånne bonuspodcaster, og at nå kom det en kjempepodcast da med Jon Nesbø, Erik Thorstvedt, Tor Christian Karlsen. Det er jo det, den forsvunne podcasten.
Ja.
Men greit da skal vi kjøre gjest, og vi har ikke engang bedt om spørsmål på Twitter, fordi her er det en historie som er så vild at vi trenger ikke spørsmål.
Nei, det er så mye å spørre om, rett og slett.
Vi har en tysker som er på vår alder, i tidlige 40-årene, som er den eneste fyren som har vært profesjonell fotballspiller på samtlige kontinent.
Ja. Lutz
Pfannenstiel.
Lutz Pfannenstiel, welcome.
Thank you.
Just start off with how many continents have you played football on?
Well, apparently there is only 5 continents really? When it comes to the geographics, but in football we have 6. Yeah. So I did play on all 6 FIFA continents, which till today I'm still the only one. Maybe one day it gets broken, but I think I will be dead by then.
You will always be the first.
Yeah, but I want to be the last. So I really know there is like I have another kind of record, which was like 25 clubs, yeah. But Sebastian Abreu, the Uruguayan guy, yeah. I think he did nothing else the last 2 years than chasing clubs to beat me.
Yeah.
Now he finally got his 25th club somewhere in the south of Chile. Nobody ever was there. And I think, you know, he's celebrating now. And funny enough, last week I broke another world record, which I never knew. They did a statistics in America, the football professionals who had the most kilometers in moving. And I beat the shit out of everybody. I had like something like 143,900 kilometers, and I was like over 100,000 in front of the second one. So people will always find some new world records.
Yep.
So I know, I think my life will be very sweet in the future.
So maybe you have a lot of other world records as well that you don't know of.
Well, I don't know them, but they always will find something.
Yeah.
So maybe the most exotic animals or there's certain things you can find.
Yeah.
But I was actually a little bit shocked when I saw the kilometers I did in moving.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how exactly they calculated it, but they did it quite good, I think, because it was a serious company.
And so it was like if you moved from Bærum to AC Milan, you had to, it was like the distance.
Exactly.
Between,
yeah. So they used it with kilometers by street, but there was another one with planes. So they found some ways.
Okay.
And because of my constant moving, especially between New Zealand and the States or New Zealand and Norway,
right.
it was quite a lot of air miles, I would say.
And also, you voted the most handsome pundit on German television in 2010, World Cup.
Yeah, but it was not very difficult.
No.
Right? I mean, Günther Netzer, I think you saw him before. He's not the youngest anymore. Meme Joel, well,
yeah.
Some people think he's cute, but I don't agree. And Oliver Kahn.
Yeah, you should beat him. I
beat him by an inch.
We're going to talk about your career in a short while, but first, what's your job today? What are you doing?
Yeah, since the last time we spoke, you know, again, lots of things are changing now. Well, put it this way. I always was known for moving every 6 months, every year. Now I'm actually very proud that in 7 years, I mean, I say it again, 7 years I'm at Hoffenheim. Started off there as the chief scout, international chief scout. Now my role has changed a little bit. It's called head of international relations and scouting, but I'm not really that much in scouting anymore. I'm together with Alexander Rosen, our sports director, supporting him at transfers, selling players, taking players in, and also have all the connections to the international clubs, organizing friendly games, organizing the trainings camp, and well, being basically very active on the transfer market.
So if Hoffenheim sells one of their players, you're the one doing it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, normal thing that we're discussing together with the coach and with Alex.
you don't go in and just sell someone.
No. I get the normal kind of like in a way, not a list, but you can say like the guys which are for sale.
Mm.
And then in cooperation with the agent of the player, as well as with other clubs I know, we're trying to find selling sounds. You know, it sounds like you're selling piece of meat or cake. It's not the way I see it. Very human, and I think it's. I always say to find a solution for a player, which maybe moving on is the best thing to do. We had like the situation, for example, with Tariq El Younoussi, which in no way everybody knows, and you know, I worked very well together with his agent and with him to find the solution in Olympiakos. And I think for Tariq to go from Hoffenheim to Olympiakos, it was definitely not a bad deal.
No,
because it's
worked out.
Yeah, it's not just a good club, but the atmosphere to play in that stadium every weekend. You know, it gives you just goosebumps. So it's a bit different than Fredrikstad.
It is,
but very close actually.
Yeah.
Fredrikstad, Olympiakos. But how do you start when you say you have Tariq not really happy at Hoffenheim? Do you ask him where he wants to go, or do you sort of picture clubs that might be interested? Or?
Well, it's more like observing the market. I mean, who needs what, you know? I mean, obviously, I know lots of managers, coaches all over the world, so you first talk to your direct contacts, and if Olympiakos doesn't look for that kind of position or that kind of player, then it's no point even if you know everybody there. So it needs to fit. So it is like sometimes you have to have a long breath and you really need to just be very awake to see what's happening. Somebody getting injured, is a coach changed, lots of like little bits and pieces. And then, then we always try. I think that is one of the things in Hoffenheim that we really work, you know, it's a small town. We work a little bit like a family.
Mm.
Also, the relationship we had with the players, also with Tariq, was always very, very good. Even when there was some time when he was injured or when he didn't play, there was still never any bad feelings. And then, of course, you feel also happy as a club if you can support the player with his agent to find a solution where he's happy. We are not trying to offload players to clubs where they don't want to go. So there is not... I'm a nice guy. So, so you can imagine. So is the rest of the club. So that's the way we're trying to work it out.
It's not like in the NHL where a player can show up for work and get the message that, oh, you are leaving New York, you are going to play in Seattle.
Well, that was done to me Toronto. All of my life. You know, I was actually pushed around like a shoebox, but I enjoyed it that way.
you like being a shoebox.
I think in the Bundesliga, there is like the, I think it's responsibility for a club to handle that kind of transfer matters very serious and very clean. And also the players, I mean, by now they're having, and the agents, they have enough knowledge and enough, background to decide for themselves if this is what they want to do or not want to do. In the end of the day, regardless if Hoffenheim or Bayern Munich or Dortmund, players have contracts, and the club in Germany, as well as in Norway, most of the clubs, I guess everybody here, we are honoring our contracts, so we have to honor our contracts. Of course, in some of the other countries, it's more difficult. Contract is worth nothing. But I think in the big leagues in Europe or in the very well-structured countries, players getting paid, the contract gets honored, and all that football business is I think very straightforward.
Unless in some of or unlike in a few of the clubs you've been playing for, it's not always been straightforward in your career, Lutz. I'm like, that's okay. You could say that.
Yeah, I mean, I played in countries where some people don't even want to travel for a holiday, you know. So it's a different kind of way of looking at things. But I, for me, I had like this really different motivation. I never motivated by financial things, because I usually decided for the, if I had a good offer, a very good offer and a normal offer, I didn't look at the money. I looked at the place where I want to go. Mm. I looked at the club. I looked at something which kind of like interests me. So it was more like a feeling of the stomach. I went for not the one in the brain. I had this one situation I remember very well, 2006. Yeah, 2006, I think. I had an offer from Steaua Bucharest, which was quite a good structure club, you know, a big name. Then Vlasnia Shkodra from Albania, which was, well, I didn't know much about them, except that they played EuroLeague qualification and stuff like that. And I had an offer from a championship team in England. But I knew in England I will end up sitting on the bench, because I know the other goalkeeper, and he was better than I was, at least I thought so.
Yeah.
Steaua Bucharest was something which, yeah, I could imagine, but this kind of Albanian thing, it just fascinated me. Because, you know, it was like this kind of thing, something secretive about it. Nobody knew where you're going. And, yeah, I mean, it wasn't all great there, but I would do it again.
You would do it again?
Yeah.
So did you play for them?
Yeah, I played there for a season. Mm. I mean, when the issue was, you know, we also had a German coach, which made it easier for me to go there. And everything went out very well till actually the coach got fired. Mm. And then they got an Albanian coach, and he wanted to get rid of all the guys that the old coach brought, like it is in football. Mm. And then it's normally, like we say now in Norway or in Germany, that, you know, they would say, okay, you have 6 months left, let's make a deal. And the way I negotiated my release was actually quite unique, because the president sat down and said in a very strong accent, let's negotiate, put a gun on the table.
He put a gun on the table. Really?
Yeah, but you know, I mean, you have to go back. A gun doesn't really scare me, right? So I used to be from all the Singapore situation where we come there, but just for them to understand, it wasn't like he didn't really, you know. I said, "Come on, mate, you won't shoot me anyway." So let's just talk straight here. And I really managed that. It was a long way. 3 weeks we negotiated.
Okay.
The gun was only there one time, though.
Yeah, but he didn't carry it with him.
And in the end of the day, I really got what I wanted. Hmm. And he actually said it was a very kind of like, yeah, he said it was a charming way of negotiating, because I just didn't listen to what he said. And I got what I wanted. But I think you have to be a bit crazy and a bit stubborn if you want to succeed or survive in that kind of football there. Then you need to have a clear mind, otherwise, you know, they will play tricks with you and you end up leaving with nothing.
Okay. Would you recommend Norwegians going to that specific club?
No. funny enough, I had I'm very, very close friends with Petar Rinkovic, former striker, actually still a striker playing now for Arendal. And he was, in my opinion, when it comes simply to goal scoring, one of the best in Norway. But he just had sometimes, maybe I would call it, a bad luck with decisions who he played for. And I actually got him there for a few days to train, and he was about to sign there, because it was they always played EuroLeague, they played decent football, you know. It was it was not a nice stadium, but it was always full. And I thought in this league, Petar, his background is Montenegrin, very close to the borderline there, but a complete different kind of, completely different people, Montenegrins and Albanians. And I think he would have done very well there. But in the end, he decided not to sign. And I think he signed for Strømskoset or for Mundalen by then. Mm. Which was probably the better decision.
but you're in, can I just ask that now? You're in Oslo now and you're looking at some Norwegian games. Are you interested in Norwegians?
No, well, we just signed Robert Nordtveit.
Yeah.
You know, so, but no, it's not that I'm like really like looking now directly at a certain player. It was also before the Liverpool game now on Tuesday. I just wanted to get. I get a bit chased by the media until you guys found me. I thought like, well, I'm coming over here. I'm going to meet a few of the coaches from the national team, like Gunnar Halle, Erland Jonsson, all that kind of like my generation, to talk about a few of the youngsters. And at the same time, I'm going to watch two or three Tippeliga games. So that's why I use the time in Oslo quite, I would say, quite well to really have my kind of tact, which is 24 hours full speed. And that's, you know, I always like to come back to Oslo, to be honest.
Because you've been playing in Bærum, Manglerudstad, and other places in Norway. But just, you mentioned Håvard Nordtveit. How's he doing?
Yeah, good. I mean, you know, he's a very well-respected player in Germany because he had a great time in Borussia Mönchengladbach. And when he went to West Ham, I mean, to go from the Bundesliga to the Premier League is somehow always is seemed to be the next step up. Maybe I think it's always, especially in Norway, the Premier League is the most watched league. Everybody loves the Premier League. So I think for him, after being educated in Arsenal, to play again in the Premier League was that what he also desired, which is probably everybody does. And yeah, I mean, for us, when we realized that there is the possibility to get him to Offenheim, you know, and we spoke with Jim Solbakken and his agent, and in the end, we were very, very happy because he, I think, was that little piece in the puzzle which was still missing to have a very experienced player. He's a real leader on the field, but also a very, very nice person off the field. So somebody which I think not just to be important to have him there as a footballer, but also in the changing room, he knows how to. He's very experienced, and
he's but a good
I think,
guy.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, for us, for our team, when we bring in foreign players like Scandinavians in general, we had like Vestergaard or Elionussi, many many Scandinavian players in the past, and it always worked out quite well. So I think for him to adjust again from the Premier League to the German League is nothing, because he played in Gladbach for so long and so successful that, yeah, he definitely is a very important player for us.
You spoke about the gun in Albania, and then you mentioned, just quickly, the Malaysia, Singapore situation. For our listeners who don't quite understand what you're talking about, what was that?
You know, it's probably the thing I'm most famous for, but obviously it's the darkest hours of my life, you know, but they made me also into probably into a different person, let's put it this way. Well, just to try to make it short.
Where were you? Which club?
Yeah, I played for Geylang United, but with E, not with A.
Around like the millennium,
99. And it was really, it was a top team there, you know, really winning titles. And it was also like by then a booming league, financially very interesting, with lots of links to the English Premier League through club corporations, and lots of players came down there at this time. And things went very, very well. And I got asked by a golfer. Sounds a bit funny, but he was a golfer. He asked me three times in my life, he asked me, hey, next week you play against this and this team, what do you think will happen? And I always said, yeah, we're in good shape, we're going to win. Two times we did win against lower teams. One time we drew and I was man of the match. And 6 months later, I was actually beaten up by the police force in regards to match fixing or corruption cases, and I didn't know really what happened to me. Well, in the end, it turned out that the guy testified against me that I gave him an advice to bet on games, which was a load of shit, to be honest. I went to court, and I had no reason not to tell the truth. I said, yes, I know this guy. I mean, I don't know his name, but he spoke with me, and he asked me the questions. I gave him that answer. And, well, he basically just added this one sentence that if he would place a bet for us to win, that he would pass me some bonus. I would have said yes, which he never asked me that question. Strange enough, whatever I just said, we did win the games. And, you know, these games were analyzed in court 100,000 times, and I did not make any mistakes. What still doesn't make me, till today, gives me sleepless nights, that a 28-year-old female judge, who doesn't know that the football is round, said to me, "You go into prison because you played better than usual." and this thing, it still really makes me angry now. Because if as a goalkeeper you lose a game and you throw three balls into your own goal, and it's obviously that there is something happening, then they can try to charge you in court. But to have the cheek to say that you played better than usual, I mean, you know, it's just not just to go for prison for that. That's on a different planet anyway. But it's very insulting to a player when you're doing your job, and you playing a clean sheet. You win 2-0. We do nothing wrong, and you're ending up.
And you were playing too well.
Too well, and then you end up in a prison which is still considered till today one of the hardest prisons in the world. Death penalty, caning. You're in a cell with 12 hardened criminals who basically getting hung in a few weeks. They are murderers, drug dealers, rapists. So all the basically the really bad guys. They were like sleeping next to me, and he asked, "Why are you here for?" "Well, I killed three people, and why are you here?" "Yeah, I played too well." So it was very it's still very difficult to get over that. Mm. However, you know, one thing which is very important, that I don't have a criminal record. So the International Court of Law, they looked at this charge and they were like saying, "Well, what is that?" So they threw it out. Mm-hmm. So I managed to, after that, I still got my work permits in the States or in Australia, in New Zealand. So I'm basically just to have a clean police record, as hopefully you two have. But just to...
I promise.
Yeah. But just to spend 101 days in such a shithole where you're basically lying on the floor, you have no toilet paper, you have no toilet, just a hole. You have hardly anything to eat, and you get every day punched in the face. You had to fight not to get raped. You had to fight to eat, you know. And for all that somebody asks you if you're going to win the next game, it's a bit for me. It's a bit too much.
Yep. It's a bit too much. I can see that. Did it change you?
Yes, it changed me a lot, because I used to be. I try to put it in a slight entertaining way. I used to be a typical footballer from my mind. I mean, I had a very good education as a child, thanks to my parents. But once you're getting drawn into that circles, you basically become a little bit lighter in your head, I would call it. So for me, it was important. Women, cars, how expensive is my shoe or my belt? You know, really these really unimportant things. So I think I was slightly arrogant ass at my high point. And once that happened to me, it just put everything in relation. I realized that the small things like family, like having friends, like trusting people, like actually be free to go to a supermarket and buy an orange juice, that these things are much more important than if your car costs 30,000 euros more or less. That you
do you sometimes have to tell younger players that?
Lots of guys, lots of players in Germany, they read my book.
Yeah.
Okay. And my book actually really focuses in one chapter on that kind of transaction from being that kind of like wannabe footballer to living it large and try to be cool, to realizing that life is much more. I mean, football is still plays the most important part in my life now, and it always will. But it puts everything in relation that, you know, I mean, it just as an example, what it have done to me. When I saw an advertisement of poor people in Africa or in Asia, I looked at it, I donated 10 euros, and 10 seconds later, my mind was gone and thinking again, where should I go for dinner tonight? Once this thing happened to me, I started to focus on other things. Now I have one of the biggest charities in the world when it comes to where football is involved, where I have 4,000 or 5,000 kids in Africa which getting every day food, drink, They're having the school, the teachers, which is all paid by my charity. So this is kind of things where I think I was so lucky all my life to actually be, well, to be able to be a footballer, to get paid for my hobby, to be paid for that, what other people, millions of people love to do, and I love as well to do. And I managed to pull myself out of the shit after Singapore to go back on my feet and still play for another 10 years now, being able to work for a Bundesliga club in a good position. And I can now give that little bit of luck I had, I can give it back to poor people in Africa.
What's the name of the charity?
Global United FC, which is, you know, by now over 500 players. I mean, when it comes to Norway, I think I can... Probably everybody in Norway is involved, like Gunnar Halle, Jana Gefjørtoft, Stig Inge Bjarneby, many, many players from that, well, I would say my generation.
Our generation, yeah.
They are involved in that, and they're coming with me sometimes to Africa. They support it, and it's actually beautiful to see. But we also have Carlos Valderrama, Zico, Rivaldo, Lothar Matthäus, you know, like, well, 500, I would say, legends, but also player who were normal, like I consider myself, who played well a few years at decent level, but also at normal level. They also support it, so it's a good community of former pros and actually current pros, who really realize that we can make a little bit of a difference by doing something for that. The charity is based on environmental issues, on climate change, and that especially in Africa, where we also, of course, support HIV and, well, we not support, we fight against HIV, where we also support soup kitchens and HIV clinics and things like that. So it's quite a big challenge. I try to go down.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
On there 2-3 times a year. We're having every year one big event where we're playing actually in Africa against this some local teams and raising the awareness, but also raising money. And that's one of, I would say, you know, it's like, I'm really passionate about it. I see that it works well. I put lots of work in it. And I think without my club Hoffenheim and without the owner of Hoffenheim, Dietmar Hopp, which supports me in this project a lot financially and also mentally, it wouldn't be able to really do it the way we do it.
Because you had a few tough years. these big stories about you. It's the one in with the 101 days in prison, but also a few years after that, you died.
Yeah, I died a bit. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was you know, it happens. Yeah. I died a bit. Yeah.
No, it was also you know, it was these 2 years where everything kind of like all the bad things came together. And just when I got back onto my feet, I played a season in New Zealand, and I only came back to England to spend a bit of time with my family and Trevor Staunton, former Liverpool player who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, was manager of Bradford Park Avenue in the Unibond League. And I just wanted to help him out to play a few games. And we had this game on Boxing Day, stadium full, you know, it's Boxing Day is like in Norway, the national day, everybody is not with flags on the street, but at least in the stadium and celebrates.
It's Christmas.
It's like, yeah, it's like the most important part of Christmas for many English people. And there was a player called Clayton Donaldson, which you all know from Hull City and from Birmingham. And he was as fast as lightning, and faster than me, of course. And it was this 50-50 ball, and unfortunately he tried to jump over me. He kind of like tripped himself. He fell with his knee into my sternum, and it was one of these freak injuries where my upper body, all the system broke down, my lungs collapsed, my heart stopped beating, so I was gone. And only the physio kind of like brought me three times back to life before the ambulance finally arrived, actually made me that I still be able to sit here. It was like a 30% chance that I will be dead, 30% that I will have some bad brain damage, and the other 30% was that I end up quite normal. So some people say it's a mix between two and three. No, that's a bad joke. So I think I was really, really lucky.
Yeah.
You know, it like this kind of like near-death experience where I don't remember too much what happened on the field, but I had this kind of like lights and all what some people describe. I had a similar experience waking up then in the hospital and realize you just basically were already on the other side, and now you have the luck and the pleasure to grace the world again for a few more adventures. I was really, really thankful for that.
And how long were you out?
Well, I was on the field. The whole situation took around 15-20 minutes, but I was around, I think, 12 to 15 minutes dead. And then I was for another hour in the coma, but I woke up then in the hospital. And once the ambulance had me, basically my brain was again, oxygen got to my brain and to my cells again. So I slowly kind of like my system was kickstarted again. But you know, it took me actually. The reaction I had to this situation was quite special. I would say I still believe I did the right thing. But because when I woke up, I was in the hospital. I didn't see clear. Everything was blur, and they strapped me on this board because they didn't really know if I broke something in the back or whatever. And my first thought was I was paralyzed. But once these nurses told me that I'm not, I basically started to scream, get me off the board, I need to go back on the field, we are 2-0 up. And only then slowly I realized that the game was actually cancelled, which never really happens in England, except something really bad is going on. And then that kind of like, made me already, of course, quite nervous. So for me, the first thing I did, actually 7 days later, I played again.
7 days?
Which was... Everybody, even the fans from the club, said it was very, very irresponsible towards my family. But I had, you are Norwegians, you understand. When a ski jumper badly falls, he tries to get on his feet as quick as possible, even if he's bruised and stitched and wants to jump again.
Get back on the horse.
Lose the fear. And it was for me the same thing. I said I was always very like physical and, threw my body in front of people's feet. That was my kind of playing style. I said, if I don't get on the field as quick as possible and I have a month to think, I will not be the same anymore. I can quit. So I really forced my way back. And when I appeared on that game day, a match day, and I said to the coach, said, oh, you're here to visit? I'm like, nah. I'm here. It's the bag. I'm going to play. And it worked out.
But was it a bad idea? Was it safe? In hindsight, would you
say? It was safe. Safe for the safe these days. Of course.
Well, what did the doctor say?
Well, the doctor said I'm crazy. But I didn't think there was any immediate danger that I would. What could happen?
I mean, what did the doctor say?
Well, he won't hit me again in the same spot, right? So no, I mean, no. So I just decided that it's I can play. It is safe to play. And I had a similar situation after 10 minutes. I did the same thing again. I got the ball, and then my fear was gone. And what is the really the foot? You know, foot is a word in German. It's called Fußballromantik, like the football romantic people. For me, whenever I go to Bradford, and sometimes I do to watch a game there, it's like always the speaker, he always says, now the man who died for our club is coming, and all the old guys who still remember, they're all standing up, and it is a very, very sentimental kind of moment for me as well.
But when things couldn't get any worse, you came to Barum.
It's a bad thing to say.
I know. But why Barum? Is it just the Albania, Singapore, Malaysia story all over again?
You wanted exotic? Some safety?
No, for me, actually, I always wanted to play in Scandinavia. Barum by then was, in the first division. And it was a very well-organized club. The coach was Trule Skullerud, which... we are still friends till today. I still believe that he is an excellent coach. You know, I mean, when by then he was also really, really young, 2003. Mm. It's a few years later now. I saw that he's...
Was he grey already?
I just want to say, I see that he's also had a lot of stress the last few years because he's very grey. Yeah. He wasn't grey by then, no. And I really enjoyed my time in Norway. You know, it was like I wanted to get some games under the belt and... from there, I had my career would have been completely different if the thing would have happened what was supposed to happen, because I had for a goalkeeper in a team which was struggling a lot of work, and for example in VG they thought I was really good. In the end of the day, I got after the season I got really lots of offers from Tippeliga clubs and also from some of the rich first division clubs. And my agent by then was a dickhead, you know?
Okay, yeah.
Because he
a Norwegian
was,
or
I don't want to
okay,
talk
yeah.
about him.
Okay, just let's call him Mr. Dickhead.
Yeah. And he was negotiating with clubs in Norway like I was an English Premier League goalkeeper. So in the end of the day, I had 6-7 options, and from month to month or week to week, they got less and less. And in the end of the day, the last option I had was to go to Hønefoss, which was by then, though, in the first division, a team with good financial backing.
Yeah.
And, I wanted to play higher up, so I decided to go somewhere else. And then I ended up actually going from Barum on a very short-term contract to Milan.
Which is a step up.
But they
don't deal with each other that much.
Yeah, but the funny part is the way it happened was like, you know, it's just very weird. There was a player called Nick Rioshaugen.
Yeah.
And Nick Rioshaugen was 2003, with 16 or 17 years. The guy was, I saw lots of talented players, but he was very special.
Yeah.
And he was really scouted by lots of scouts from all over Europe, because he was a 6-year-old boy which was unbelievably fast in the Norwegian first division, which was very physical, and he did a great job. So lots of teams were looking at things, and there was a scout from Milan who saw me playing two times, and I was two times quite good. And I had already some English Premier League teams on my CV and stuff like that, so I wasn't like already in a decent age and not known at all. So when there was Dida and Abiati, both of them were, Dida was fit, Abiati had always problems. So they said, well, we sign you on a non-contract, just on a week-to-week, basically. You're training with the reserves or sometimes with the first team. And if Abiati doesn't get fit and you train well, maybe we get you in. And if not, well, you know, I basically had nothing to do after the season in Barum was finished. it was a great experience in Milanello. And in the end of the day, there was they had like some kind of farm club in Canada who played in the American League. And then after Abiati got fit again, they actually helped me to organize quite a good deal in Calgary. So I went from Barum, from Sandvika, via Milanello, directly into Calgary, where it was minus 42 degrees. So it was like hello, Alta. You know, okay. It was very, 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 very cold as well.
I remember Alta, yeah. That makes an impression on people. But you have some different clubs as well on your CV that not that many people have, like Bentonit Ijevan?
Ijevan, yeah. I was like player manager there in a club in Armenia.
Yeah.
Which also like a completely screwed up story. You know, I was supposed to sign for Punic, which is the big club there, yeah. Champion. And then there was a guy who looked a bit like you, actually.
Uh-oh.
Seriously. He came and
bald
said...
Bald and the beard?
Yeah. He said, well, I'm Armenian millionaire. I'm having some of this and that. And I want to buy my own club, build my own club. And I have the license for a club to play here, which he did. And he basically gave me the club. He says, like, buy as many foreigners and what you want. So I just took everybody you can imagine. Argentinians, Mexicans, Croatians. The only thing that was missing was a guy from Alta. So I really had a good team, and we won everything. I was player manager. And after 3.5 months, the guy didn't pick up the phone anymore. The bank account was empty. So as quick as the club appeared, as quick he disappeared. And it was a fantastic way to learn what I'm doing now, because I was still quite young, more like a player's head, and I needed to try to find the right mixture, speak with lots of people to see who I can get on a loan deal and stuff like that. And it was like I would say it was a beautiful nightmare, because I learned a lot. It was special, but the way it ended was very sad. And guess where I went from there?
Back to Barum.
but again, with Barum, it is more. Barum is for me like it is a big place in my heart. It's a bit like a family club, you know. It's very good youth system. Everybody knows everybody. The area, you know, down there in Sandvika, it's a lovely place, lovely people, and it's just if I'm 85. And I can't walk anymore, and Barum will call and say, please, we have an injured goalkeeper, play one game. I would actually jump in my canoe, I would come up, and I would play, because it's like something where I have this special connection and that special feeling too.
I don't know many Germans who do have those feelings.
With a canoe.
Never met a German in a canoe. But you've been coaching in Cuba, and you lived in Windhoek in Namibia.
Yeah.
Do you miss traveling?
Living
places.
Yeah, I'm still traveling a lot, but of course it have changed a lot now, because before I stayed like in Windhoek 1.5 years, I also became national coach there. After a while, Cuba was more in and out. But this kind of like being somewhere for a year or for 6 months or for the season. New Zealand, I was 6 times for 6 months, but never in a row because of the short season. It is a different way of traveling, because you are automatically involved in the normal kind of life. You're not like a tourist who travels there for a few days and then goes again. So now it is more that I'm like, no, here for 5 days, here for 3 days. So it has changed a bit. But to be fair, I think I did find my way now. I'm very happy with that, what I'm doing. So this kind of mix between sitting in the office in the tracksuit, but also flying to watch a Premier League game, or selling a player with a suit on, and 3 days later do a television show as an expert, which I do a lot. It's like a mixture which kind of like really fulfills my way of how I like my life to be. And now I settled down now in Frankfurt, which is a place I mean, I'm not the biggest friend of living in Germany. I am honest about that. But I learned it again. You know, it took some time to get used to the lifestyle there. Mm-hmm. So I think I found my way now, the way I enjoy. And I think it's all good.
You just mentioned when we got the coffee that you'd... you thought that was Norwegian coffee was pretty strong, but you also mentioned that you had Burundian coffee when you were from Burundi.
Yeah.
How many countries have you been to, do you know?
Yeah, actually, if you would go on my Facebook page, I counted them a few months ago, a few weeks ago, and I think it was quite a lot, but there is still a lot of missing, because there is some places where we never will get to. Yeah, but when you talk about, I just look at my beautiful cup of Norwegian coffee in front of me. I don't understand how you guys actually can drink that, because you get blind. You know, it is so strong and kind of like sour. Put a little bit of milk on it, maybe a little bit of sugar, and then, but it's really strong.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I like it. I can see.
Yeah, but not very well.
No, that's true.
But you, I've never drunk coffee. You say it's stronger than espresso? Is it? But how?
Your coffee is like acid. It's sour. You know, I mean, if you put it in somebody's face, he probably probably can play in a horror movie. I don't know. It's just very strong. It sounds unique, but I like it. I mean, I got used to it. I remember in Barum again, the first time I drank this coffee, I used to be like, I didn't drink coffee at all. And then I had this coffee and it really kind of like energized me. I was like, wow, my God, what's going on now? So, yeah, it's like one of the things which I really, when I come to Norway, that cup of coffee excites me. Another thing which is, you will think now I'm like a little kid. When I arrive at Gardermoen, you know what is the first thing I do?
Hot dog. Norwegian chocolate.
No, the hot dog I get a bit later. Chocolate, I'm not so much into it. You know, there is these Swedish candies, Billa.
Bilar.
I eat one packet within like 30 seconds and I wash it down with this villa, this drink. Like a little child, but this is for me Norway. This is the things I have in my mind. And then afterwards it's the hot dog and then I'm
then you're back
then
home.
Then I'm ready to do my work.
Like a little baby on the train.
So I went on your Facebook. You've been to 145 countries.
Of how many?
That's when they say that it's 250, so then included quite a number of territories, I guess. Yeah. But still, it's quite a lot.
It's quite a lot, yeah.
will you cross the 200 line?
You know, I'm not too sure, because I think these countries where I was, that is the ones where you have on the football map. Mm-hmm. So these kind of smaller countries which I haven't been, I don't think necessarily I will go to St. Kitts and Vincent to find a footballer.
No.
So I mean, obviously I will still go to two or three which are missing, but it would be another world record if you probably make all of 250.
Yeah.
Norwegians are always complaining about Norwegian football. Mm-hmm. Always. It's always, everything's wrong all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you've lived here and now you're visiting and you got a big job in Hoffenheim. Do you agree with Norwegians saying everything is wrong with Norwegian football, or can you give some comfort?
No, I don't agree at all. You know, I think Norwegians watching too much Premier League. Mm. So you see the best of the best. Then you obviously compare it to Sandefjord's Sogndal. And then it's not as fast anymore as Manchester United. But that's very normal. Mm. I didn't say now that these two teams playing bad football. Just want to give an example.
One of the games you saw on Friday.
Yeah. But how do I say? I think that these players, this big amount of top players you had in the 90s, Grodas, Halle, Bjarneby, Fjørtoft, all these, you know,
Rekdal, Solskjær, Henningberg.
I would say 25 of them who made their career in England, in Germany, all over the world, and they were outstanding. That kind of generation is not there right now. But you still have very good players. You still have, I look now at the team of Gunnar Halle, this 2001 born, you know, and there is good players. They just won a tournament in Iceland. There is some talents. So I just think it's looking at the game Norway-Germany a few months ago, well, let's say it wasn't really looking like Norway could do it big. But now with Lagerbäck coming in, kind of like just changing things again, I think there is again the way forward. But I just really think that at the moment, this generation who is playing right now, there is not that many top players as there used to be. But in the future, it will come. Lots of Norwegians say we don't have good coaches. I don't agree with that at all, because you do have a very, very talented coaches. You have intelligent coaches. I think that Per-Mathias Høgmø was a very good coach. He just had not a good run with the national team. I think that the financial situation in Norwegian football has changed a bit as well. If I look back at the time when Jan Hage was sports director in Lillestrøm, the players who were playing in Norway by then were just simply better. When I look back to the Swedish striker from Stabæk, Daniel
Nanskog, yeah,
that was exciting players.
Bergar Pál Gunnarsson,
Alan Zino from Stabæk. That was the time when I was here. That were players who were like, very very interesting. But I also at the moment see a development at the moment in Norway is that every team has 2-3 African players. Some of these African players are really really good. Like they're really impressive. They're very young. Other ones I think are not as good, and it would be maybe better if you having given Norwegian talent this position. So it's just to find the right mixture. But I mean, as you hear, I'm maybe not as critical as maybe I should be. It's just simply because I like Norway. I like the clubs. I know many managers. I know many coaches, and I see that they're working hard and they doing well. And look, for example, now at Sandefjord with Lars Boinen. I think they're doing fantastic looking at the financial situation they have, what budget they have compared to Germany, for example, looking the way they play football. I think it's good.
Og Sarpsborg. Sarpsborg ser jo
same. I mean, very fantastic. They're working very very consistent. Mm. Resigning now, I think 5-year contracts with everybody at the club. That shows that they want to work continuously with a clear structure, with a clear system. That's very good. Looking, I mean, for example, Stig-Inge Bjarneby now up in Rosenborg. I mean, that's just a good team, you know. I mean, it was unlucky. How unlucky is it to get drawn against Ajax? How unlucky was it to get drawn against Celtic? And they nearly did it. So it's not everything is bad. It's just sometimes you need a bit of change in time, and it will work again.
In a small country, you need the generation to be. Yeah. To be good. You've been all over the place for many years, 6 months in this place and that place, 7 years in Hoffenheim. Will you stay there forever? Is this it for Lutz van Stiel?
Well, I have a long-term contract, and my contract is still for a few years to go. And of course, sometimes you get that kind of tickle in your feet, you know. I had an offer a few years ago, actually 2 years ago, from a club in Saudi Arabia to coach them. An offer from an African national team to coach them. And of course, you do think for a few seconds. But now being settled, you know, also with the family there, daughter is in university.
It is kind of nice.
My dog, I have a dog which I love like a human. You know, so all these kind of things which I didn't know before, they slowly coming into my... They're growing into my life. So never say never, but at this moment in time, I really don't have any kind of thought. I'm not looking for change. Before, I was always looking for it. Mm. I always had the feeling when I played in New Zealand, I wanted to play in a better league. When I went to England and I didn't play, I wanted to play in a smaller league to play. So I couldn't make up my mind what I want to do. And that's when you have that kind of mindset, then you start to jump. Now it's all a bit more settled. As I said, I also work a lot on my television career in Germany, or also with BBC, which I enjoy a lot. So right now, no, I wouldn't change a lot.
You're happy.
I'm happy, yeah. But I was always happy.
You have always been happy every time we met you for the last 15 years. Yeah,
maybe in prison. There was a few days where I wasn't too happy.
But a few hours when you were in a coma and died. That was a few bad hours. Lutz,
you're going to hang out with Tor Odal Skuldre, so we have to let you go.
Yes. Yep. He just called me this second and probably get pissed off that I didn't answer my phone. Yeah. I'd say it was your fault.
Blame us. No worries. And he'll understand. Last time we met him, he had a terrible flu.
Drammen?
In Drammen. Mm. He was even grayer.
I was there yesterday. I mean, I actually enjoyed the game.
It was a good atmosphere. Lutz, thank you. Thomas, vi ferdig for I dag, vi.
Ja, vi jo tilbake neste uke, vi.
Selvfølgelig vi det. Ja. Jeg ikke idioter heller, men vi kan ikke love at neste ukes gjest har dødd eller sitter I et fengsel I Singapore.
Nei, vi skal prøve.
Vi skal prøve.
Ja.
Ha det!
I'm standing here in front of the Eiffel Tower. What a magic.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.